This is your host, Sarah Nayani, and I've got such a good episode today that I've been saving for you guys. At the end of season one of the podcast, I asked for suggestions for season two, and you guys wanted to hear more about dahlias, like dahlia growing, dahlia breeding, and dahlia virus, and you wanted to hear from some larger growers as well. So lucky for all of us, Leanne Huber from Cozy Town Flowers stopped by the pod to cover all of that and more. And what perfect timing to be releasing this episode, because I'm looking out my window into the driveway garden at dahlia blooms. And actually, the ones that are right under my window are Cozy Town Bounty, Cozy Town Gale, and Cozy Town Lion's Mane, which are three of Leanne's varieties that she bred. It is such a late year for dahlias this year, with the cold spring that we've had in Seattle. Last year, I had blooms from early pinch varieties in late June, and this year in mid-July, I'm still waiting for blooms on the plants that I pinched. The only reason I have blooms in the driveway right now is because, as you'll hear in the interview with Leanne, I went on a trip to the East Coast when the driveway dahlias were really small. It was a little too early to pinch. And when I got back, they were huge and they already had buds. So I decided my first pinch on those ones in the driveway would be their first flower. So I had a couple broomstick-sized stems on the first flowers that I cut off those plants, but since I pinched them, they've been throwing out smaller stems with lots of blooms and getting a little bit bulkier, bushy plants. And then for the beds in my sidewalk beds, where it's a little bit cooler, I was back in time for my trip to pinch those. So those plants have been bulking up and they're just now setting buds. So it'll probably be another couple weeks for blooms on those, which is very late compared to last year. It's pretty wonderful in the garden right now because the sun is finally out in Seattle and all the plants are responding. My snapdragons are finishing up their blooms, and I'm going to clear some of those out to make a little more room. And then I'll leave one bed in to get a flush of side shoots, which will have smaller blooms on those snaps. And then last week, I started harvesting Bells of Ireland. This is my first year growing them from seed, and I love them. They add a wonderful texture and like dimension to arrangements and bouquets, and they have a really great fragrance, which I wasn't expecting. So here's an example of really intensive growing in a small space. The packet said 12-inch spacing for bells, and I think I did 6-inch. So if you give them the full 12, I think they grow these enormous tall stalks with lots of bells or the cup-shaped discs that grow up the stem. But with my tighter spacing, it actually worked well for me because I was putting them in bouquets this year and the stalks grew to about 2.5 feet and they had smaller spikes with that smaller spacing, which I think actually balanced really well with the designs that I'm making. But I think the huge ones would be fantastic for installations. They would make a really big impact. So I want to try some with 12-inch spacing too next year and compare how they look. I sent a note home with some of my subscription arrangements and bouquets to customers last week because I wanted to get their take, and I'd love yours too, on the Bells of Ireland fragrance. I really can't describe it. It's like maybe somewhere in the like mint, lime, vanilla realm. I really just like can't pin it down. So I was wondering if you guys have smelled Bells of Ireland and if you have any thoughts on the fragrance or like description of the fragrance. I'll throw a poll up in the Flower Friends podcast Instagram stories so you can drop it there if you have thoughts. Anyway, it's a really cool flower or foliage, I guess. As someone who grows both my own flowers and then I buy in flowers, I hadn't seen any Bells of Ireland at the market before, so I really wanted to try growing them this year. And that's really the fun of growing seeds for me, is it's so much cheaper than plants that you can buy at the nursery or from plugs. And I love trying new things, new varieties and colors that I haven't seen before. And I kind of go into it with the attitude of, if this works, it's awesome, and if it doesn't, it's not the end of the world. A lot of times with seeds, I'll grow a whole tray of a favorite variety and not have room for all of those seedlings to go into beds anyway. So some of the seedlings die. It's not a big deal. It's kind of expected, and that's okay. And the other thing that amazes me about seeds still is like the size of the seed compared to the size of the flower. And so if I'm just using snapdragons as an example, those seeds are smaller than like a pinhead. And then the flower, like the total cone spike, you know, can be like 6 to 8 inches. And so it's got to be like 1/1000th of the size of the flower is like the seed size. And that just kind of blows my mind. Like if you think about a tulip bulb, that makes more sense to me. It's like about an inch big maybe, and the flower is going to be like 2 to 3 inches, maybe bigger depending on the variety. But that's like, you know, what, a fifth or a third of the size, like the bulb to the flower. But the seeds just like blow my mind because they're so small and they can turn into these big flowers. So, and yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of the bulb varieties, they'll come back year after year, and a lot of the seeds are just annual, but I'm growing some perennials and biennials from seeds. So it just really amazes me. It's a really low cost, low risk way to try something new. Speaking of seed starting, I wanted to talk a little bit about succession planting, because even though I'm going into my third year of pretty intensively growing flowers in a small space, I'm still not nailing it with the timing on succession planting and crop rotation. So the idea behind succession planting is that you can extend the harvest of one crop through the year. So for example, you might sow seeds of one variety, let's say zinnias or snapdragons, a few weeks apart so that when the first round of seeds are full plants and they're blooming and then they finish blooming, you'll have another set of the same plant, which is your second succession, that will start blooming soon. So just say with snapdragon, say you sow the first one in January and then the second round in February, and you're going to plant those out into the garden at about a month apart also. And in theory, you'll get blooms about a month apart. It does depend on the varieties that you're sowing, because some will actually catch up or some are earlier bloomers than others. But let's just use for this example, you're sowing your seeds inside a month apart, you're planting them out into beds a month apart, and in theory, you'll have blooms about a month apart so that you kind of have continuous harvest. I've found both this year and last year that where I'm running into trouble with that plan is around April. So from January to March, when there's not much going on outside, I'm feeling really organized. It's a new year. I've got my spreadsheets. I've got my seeds organized. I've got my plan. I love growing seedlings at that time in my indoor shelves because there's not much going on outside. It's nice to have something green, something alive, something to focus on inside. And it's really dark out those months, so it's nice to have the grow stand with the lights that stay on. It's just this extra bright, happy thing. And there's all this hope that time of year. So I really put a lot of energy and time into my seedlings and feel pretty confident during those months that I'm going to have successions of different plants and that I'm going to have a lot of different varieties of seeds that I'm sowing. And in theory, I've kind of gamed out my bed space of where I'm going to put things and when. But once things start growing outside, it's harder for me to get started with seeds. So like when I'm harvesting tulips and daffodils, anemones, ranunculus in like the late March, April, sometimes even into early May timeframe outside, and then I'm trying to get those cut flowers into customers' hands, and then I'm cleaning out those beds that had those early spring blooms and trying to put my seedlings into those beds, like the snapdragons or foxgloves or whatever I've grown inside that I'm putting outside. I can do that, but then I really lose track on sowing new seeds. And where I'm really feeling that is this time of year, like midsummer. And this happened to me last year too, so you would think I would learn my lesson, but I wanted to mention it in case this is something that you guys want to do when you're planning out your future years. Because now that I'm seeing my records and I'm actually going back, I have all these great laid plans in January, but when it comes to this time of year, I'm really feeling the crunch. And that's because I didn't sow a lot more seeds at the times that I had planned to in like April and May. And so now when some of my sort of mid-spring varieties or like biennials like foxgloves are starting to finish blooming or my poppies, I don't have a ton of seedlings that I'm ready to put in there. And it can be a little bit too late in the year this time of year to plant certain varieties. Like snapdragons can take, you know, over 100 days from the time you plant the seed to the time you get a flower. So it might be a little too late in the year to start something like that. So I'm filling beds with the remaining seedlings that I had ready to go out. And then I've been planting some things that are shorter blooming varieties, like zinnias you can actually get to bloom in a shorter time frame. So I've done a few more of those, and then sunflowers. I actually did some cosmos too, because those can bloom later into the fall, and I did some marigolds as well. But crop rotation is another thing with succession planting that also kind of throws me for a loop, because I am growing in a small space. I have a limited number of beds, and it can be really hard with the timing. Like, you sow seeds and those seedlings, it might be too early. They might be too small to plant outside when you have a bed ready. So you'll put something else there. And then where do you put those seedlings that were a little too small? And then you have to bump those up into bigger, you know, like containers, like a 4-inch little pot, so that you can plant those out. And it becomes this like really interesting, I've referred to it before as a Tetris game, where you've got a bunch of stuff that's ready to go and there's no bed to put it in, or you've got some things that are too small. And so it's just this game that you have to figure out. And I'm getting a little bit better at it year after year, but I definitely wanted to mention that it's this time of year where I really feel like I let the organization from my seed planting go in like the April, May timeframe. And so now when some of my varieties are ready to move out, I'm trying to figure out what to put into those beds. One thing that's really been saving me is perennial plants. And so when I first started, I was planting a lot of annuals because you can grow those from seed. They're a lot easier to grow and get started. And, you know, perennials are a big investment, like a peony or a rose, a ninebark plant, a mock orange plant, chrysanthemums, things like that. They cost more money up front, but they'll come back year after year. And so over time, I've been adding perennials, and that's really helped both in terms of having flowers between that early spring flush and the early summer flush, and then also with having blooms more consistently going that I don't have to think about as much because they're already in the bed. They stay there through the year and they come back year after year. And then I don't have to think about seed sowing with those. So I've mentioned on the podcast before that I've been moving more of my annual beds into perennial beds as I'm able to kind of add money, invest money in perennials. And that's been helping with the seed starting, but I do have a significant number of beds that I try to use for annual flowers. And so both for myself and as a reminder for anyone else who's thinking about lessons from this year for next year, one of my major ones will be to think about trying to get a few of those really key varieties that you just can't buy in the nursery or other places, you know, certain varieties that you just can't get easily, to sow those seeds myself in April. If I can just do like 1 or 2 days that I set aside, you know, even just a morning to sow some seeds, it would save me a lot of money and time and have something to just throw right into the bed that I'm really going to use throughout the summer and fall. Okay, since the interview that we're just about to get to is about dahlias today, I thought I would do the Flower Friends flower fact as a dahlia question. So here's your question. According to the American Dahlia Society, how many dahlia forms are there and how many can you name? And the dahlia form is speaking about the shape, the size, the petal form of the dahlia flower itself. And with that, let's get to the interview. Mm-hmm. Today, I'm so excited to welcome Leanne Huber from Cozy Town Flowers to the podcast. Welcome, Leanne.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to speak with you today.
Could you give us a little bit of a rundown on your business, like where you're located and what you grow?
Sure thing. So I run Cozy Town Flowers from South Central Pennsylvania in a small town called Greencastle. And it's a nice little area because I feel like in Pennsylvania, we get the best of all the worlds. Like we have every season, we don't have extreme weather. And I found it to be a perfect place to grow dahlias.
And this is a family business, farming, right?
I grew up in farming. So I think on my father's side, farming has gone back 6 or so generations.
Wow.
I haven't tracked it back further than that. And so I grew up firmly in like animal agriculture. So we did beef cattle, dairy, a lot of hay. I was much more fit when I was younger doing all that work. And I have an ag degree, but I left that when I had my career. And so I worked outside of agriculture for about 15 years. And then when I had my kids, I've always gardened. That's always been a hobby of mine. I just felt like I really needed the land that we had purchased to work for itself. I think that's an innate thing if you grow up in agriculture. And so I thought, well, let me start a business and see if my land can pay for itself, meaning, you know, pay for its property taxes.
Yes.
and it just kind of started there, and I'm where I am today right now.
Wow. And how did you turn to flowers? Like, how did you first get interested in dahlias?
I have to blame the land that I purchased. If I had flat, dry land, I would probably have like a feedlot growing steers or something, but I have nice rolly land that has a lot of springs. And so, you know, it just comes down to a little bit of fate and a little bit of luck and really experiencing dahlias for the first time over a decade ago. And being completely enamored and falling in love with them and realizing I could grow them, I could store them, I could multiply them. And the obsession took over and I had the space to allow that to happen.
Well, thank you for bringing the beautiful dahlias that you have to the world, because it's helping with growing other people's obsessions.
So. I do my best.
So what is like the size and the layout of your growing space? I know you said it's rolling hills, but about how big is the land that you grow on?
We own 4 acres, but I grow on a lot less. And when you're growing a single crop for propagation, you don't need a lot of land. So this year I have about 4,000 plants in the ground. About 3,200 of them are tubers. A little over 800 are seedlings. They're what I find my new varieties in. And if I had to measure it and equate it to acreage, it would probably be about 1/4 of an acre. It's a really intensive operation. I waste no space.
So you have a breeding program where you're bringing new dahlias to the scene. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the varieties that you've already released.
I have about 15, a little bit more on the market. Sometimes when I release a new dahlia, I'll do it for 1 year only. It's just because I like it and I didn't want to throw it away. And I had some tubers and it has value, but if it was my daughter, you know, it's more the rare ones, she says, when it comes to some of her toys that she likes. But there's varieties like Cozy Town Baby Cakes, and they all carry the Cozy Town prefix. So there's just a couple, K, Early Girl, Bounty, Lion's Mane, just a few. And they're all, you can view them on my website at cozytownflowers.com if you really wanted to check them all out.
And when you're breeding, so you're growing from seeds, like you mentioned, and could you take us a little bit through the process of how you kind of collect those seeds and then determine which ones you're collecting them from and planting them out?
I sure can. So my breeding program focuses on finding dahlias that work well for cut flowers. And as I mentioned before, like I come from this ag background. And when I was trying to find dahlias that worked well for cut flowers, just using what was available through big box stores or larger internet stores, I kept coming up disappointed when I would grow the dahlias and they just weren't as productive as I hoped they would be, or the stems weren't strong enough or long enough, or they didn't have the vase life. And so over a period of years, I've collected several varieties that I just fell in love with and I felt like they were very profitable plants for farmers. And so those plants are what I used and started with to collect seed from. And so I hoped, and it worked out, that those genetics would give me seedlings that had the traits I was looking for. And so every fall I would plant those dahlias together and collect those seeds, letting the bees do the pollination. This was the early years, and just hoped for the best possible outcome. So that's how it started.
Basically, the bees were doing the work between varieties that you loved. Mm-hmm. And then you were collecting the seed heads and then planting them out the next year.
Yep.
And then it's a magical surprise to see what you get.
It is what I look forward to the most every year. Shh, don't tell my kids with their birthdays. But it's such a magical experience because dahlias are so genetically diverse, the seeds never look like the offspring. And that can be good and that can be bad, just because there's so many genetics at play. So every time one opens, it's the one and only in the world, and you never know what you're going to get. And when you get that magical one, I mean, it just hooks you and you never let go.
We got some listener questions about your hybridizing, and Margaret from Ballard Urban Flowers asked which dahlia form and color you're the most excited to hybridize or that you might be working on right now.
I will say I actually don't pay attention to color and form as much as other breeders, because I'm very interested in the plant habit. And if the plant grows well and the flower is attractive, I let the customer decide what they want as far as color and form. But I really hope that my plants perform well as far as making tubers, ample tubers, they store well, and that they're just plants that produce a lot of blooms. So if you are in the business of growing cut flowers for any market, these plants are just going to be reliable for you. So when I'm picking seed parents, I actually prefer to look at the other traits I just mentioned. And then I hope for the best for the flower. However, I do love those really odd and unique blooms. And so I get a little excited when one of those shows up in my breeding patch.
Yes. One that I love is is it called Peach Donut?
Yes.
The ring with the open center. It's so cool. The flower form on that.
What's unique about that one, so it's Cozy Town Peach Donut, is that most of the time when they're open centered, so that is a true open centered dahlia that has a nice halo, an even halo of petals around it. And if it was a fully double dahlia, I bet it would be a ball form, but it's not. And in typical form, open centered dahlias immediately start to make pollen once the petals unfurl, but this variety does not. It'll actually stay closed centered for quite a while. And I think that's what makes it a better cut flower, because as soon as a flower starts to pollinate, that bloom is done. It's done its job. It attracted the pollinators because the plant wants to make seed. So Peach Donut is a little different, where it actually has a longer vase life for being an open center dahlia. And then of course it's a beautiful color and it's just so uniform. I think that's what makes it so attractive.
Definitely. Well, do you have any go-to dahlia parents that you could share with us? And I mentioned that I know this is a little bit of an impolite question, so I'm not trying to like go anywhere you don't want to, but if there's any that you love working with or plant traits or habits that you're trying to replicate, that would be awesome to hear about.
Now, every girl keeps their secrets, but I love sharing. So, but I implore people to pick their favorite plants if they want to start growing from seed. There's something about those plants that you love. And if you got a seedling that had that same trait, you're going to love it too. And I shared how I started as far as picking plant habits that I like. So I look for plants that meet all my breeding requirements. And so I have used, or I am using, Snow Hosonia would be one. Fluffles is another one. They're completely different forms and colors, but in general, their seedlings make plants that I really like. Not all the flowers are beautiful, but their plants are pretty consistent. I also use some of my own seedlings in my breeding program. So like Cozy Town Gale, I've used, and I actually sold seed from Gale this past season. Holly Hill Kris Kringle, and of course the ever-loving Peaches and Cream. That's always a great one to start with.
Yeah, I just saw one that you had on your Instagram that it looked a little bit like Peaches and Cream, but it had some purple in it. That looks so cool. Was that an offspring of Peaches and Cream?
That was not. But then again, I don't know where all my pollen parents are because I let the bees do the pollination.
Are you doing any hand pollination at all, or is it all from the bees?
Right now, it's all from the bees. I have to leave something to do when I'm in retirement.
Yes. That's a great way to look at it.
Hand pollination takes a lot of time. I tried it. You don't get as good of results. The bees do a much better job. And honestly, they've done me really good. So I'm just going to continue to let them do their work.
And then once you've found a variety that you're really in love with from your seedlings, how long does it usually take to bring that to market and have a sale of that tuber?
Typically, so you start with one seedling that gives you one plant. And what you hope happens is that that plant makes tubers. And typically it does. You don't know how many. And then you have to get through saving that plant over winter. And this is the time where it's either going to do it or not. And every year you lose seedlings. It's just what happens. And you just hope for a better one next year. But if it survives its first year completely from growing to storage, I typically plant all those tubers back, especially if it's a favorite.
Okay.
And so I typically can take that one plant to four or five tubers. That's an average. From that point, I evaluate the second year and see if that's something I want to continue with propagation. Typically, whatever I kept that first year, I divide by half the second year and I get rid of half of the second year seedlings. The second year, like the rose colored sunglasses come off and you see the plant for what it is, you're not so in love with it and you really can look at it with a more critical eye. And then I take the second years to a third year for another evaluation. Sometimes I can't because of space plant all the tubers again. So I just have enough to do another really great evaluation of the plant. And by the third year, it's either it's going to make it or not. I either have to decide to market it or not.
Okay.
And at that point is when I really begin propagation. So it can take about 5 years, if not more, for me to bring something to market on my scale.
Wow. I think when people think of dahlia breeding, they don't realize how much goes into it, how much evaluation, especially for the traits that you're looking for. It's probably hard to find.
Yeah, consistency is one of the things I'm really looking for. And with the propagation, I typically just propagate with tubers. I do cuttings on occasion, but that's not my main form of propagation.
Okay. And someone was asking, if you do take cuttings, how many do you usually take from each tuber? This is someone who I think is wanting to buy in some dahlia tubers and do cuttings at home. And she was just wondering how many you think is viable from a given tuber.
Keep an eye on your tubers. So I call them mother tubers. They're propagating for you and you're either going to plant it to get more tubers or you're planting it to get cuttings. If I do it, I'm not greedy because I do like to plant that tuber back in the field. And let that grow.
Okay.
In an advanced propagation setting. So people who do cuttings as a business or they're large scale commercial growers, they'll take as many cuttings as they can before the cuttings get too weak and thin. Because what you're doing is you're asking that tuber, which is a stored nutrient source, to keep putting energy out without it getting any energy in. Because as soon as that cutting or that sprout starts making leaves, the goal of that is to feed that tuber and form roots. Well, you're taking that off every single time. So eventually the tuber is going to be depleted and it'll weaken. But for me, I find that I can take 5-6 cuttings and it's still willing to grow in the field and take and make tubers for me. I don't really push it more past that. I know some people can take 10 or more, but I also have a limitation of space. So keep that in mind.
And how do you store your dahlia tubers between like when you're saving them each season?
It's evolved over time. Right now I use a CoolBot walk-in cooler system that I have installed in my basement. It's worked really well. I'm able to keep the temperature anywhere I want it, but I keep it around 42 to 44 degrees all winter long. And the humidity, I like to keep it around 80 degrees. And that's the trickiest part is keeping your humidity where you need it. But I've used a real root cellar from my neighbors. I've used my mom's cellar in her basement. Like she has a legitimate dirt floor type of cellar basement. They're perfect. I've tried to store them in containers in my garage or my basement. And the first few years, I've pretty much killed every tuber I tried to keep until I found a system that works. So if you're having failure, success could be right around the corner. And that's just the optimistic nature I have. But it's just really finding the right conditions because they are very much like a potato.
I had messaged you because I tried to store all of my tubers in my shed outside thinking it was the right conditions. And then unfortunately they got really molded and we had a huge freeze come in, which is really unusual for Seattle. And so some of them rotted out from the freeze as well, but the sole survivor was Cozy Town Bounty.
So, that's remarkable.
I have a whole, I have two beds of Cozy Town Bounty because I'm just like, it was such a strong plant and there were so many flowers from each of them. So you were joking that maybe it was the first like cold hardy tuber, but do you think that there's, you know, more movement towards types of varieties that do store well and that are a little bit easier for home growers to kind of get a handle on?
I think in our nature as humans, there's only so much failure we'll accept.
Yes.
Or maybe it's just Americans. I don't know. But yes, I do. And there are some, if you grow enough varieties, you'll notice that you can leave something that you don't like on the counter or on the basement floor all winter long, and it does completely fine. And the one that you really want will rot or, you know, completely desiccate. So there's clearly something in some of these dahlias that makes it more hardy than others. And that's one thing I'm working towards.
Great. We love to hear that. I was wondering a little bit about how the process of your tuber sale goes, because I can only imagine and like have heard about some of the chaos of just all the orders coming in and this dahlia mania and how you kind of get your counts ready and keep everything organized. Could you kind of let us behind the scenes a little of like how you run your tuber sale and how you stay organized when you do that?
Well, it's a process and I have to take off any romantic flower farmer ideals and put on my shipping logistics manager hat, which is my least favorite job that I do. I am never working in any sort of warehouse. It's not fun. But being extremely organized is important for me. So every tuber gets a stamp when divided. So even if by chance something happens and they get mixed up, they can still be identified. But I do keep every single variety, whether it be a seedling or a known named variety, in their own bins or crates, and I store them in that cool box cooler. For the sale, anything that's for sale gets put in, you know, those racking systems that mechanics use that have bins that you can label but see into?
Yes.
I forget the real name of them, but that's what I use now. And it's all on wheels. So I can roll them in and out of the cooler. Everything is alphabetized. And so with the new e-commerce system I'm using, I'm able to pull orders in lots and pick into bins, like 25 orders at a time. And it's just telling me they need this and this and this. And I go through alphabetically. And it seems this is the best year I've ever had in getting all the orders out because it takes a considerable amount of time. And if you ask anyone who sold tubers for the first year, that's probably their first thing to say, that I had no idea that shipping was going to be such a process.
I thought about even like selecting the boxes of a person who orders just one and a person who orders eight. It's like so much manual thought and preparation that must go into that. So it's good to hear a little bit more about that.
I know. And when you start this process, you realize you're not just a grower. If you are in tuber production for sales, that you are shipping a product and a perishable product at that. And it actually makes you really appreciate smaller tubers. Growers want to see these great big tubers. And I'm like, no, I need to fit them in a box.
And then I think that you have shown a few sneak peeks of some second and third year seedlings or new varieties that you might bring to market. And I was wondering if you have any that you could describe or talk about that you think might come out in 2023.
So you want the scoop?
You don't even have to give full details. Just, I don't know. Are there a few that you're excited about?
I am. And I mean, if you see my Instagram, you know that I really like to share and I can't keep anything back, especially when new blooms are blooming. My stories are completely full of the first bloom images because, yeah, it's super exciting. But I have a few that I'll talk about. So one that I've been showing for years and no one's been able to get their hands on is one called Bermuda Pink. Now, this is a dahlia that was grown from Cozy Town seed, but grown from a customer of mine that lives in Bermuda. So she had the seeds shipped in, and this particular beautiful blushy pink dahlia that has these graceful petals that go all the way back around the stem. It's like anybody having an event is going to want this dahlia. It's just so beautiful. And I was able to get some tubers and I've been propagating it since. In the fall, what's interesting about this one, so it stays baby pink all year, but it sports to a true bronze in the fall sometimes. And it's very rare and it's not consistent, but it's the closest I've ever seen to a brown dahlia. Wow. So for all everyone's like, I need this brown or neutral, or I need this baby pink. This plant might give you both. So it's kind of exciting. There's also a cactus type bloom. Now, I don't have many cactuses in my field. Personally, I don't really fall in love with that form as much as others. And I find that a lot of the, at least my local floral customers, they don't use that form very much in their weddings. But I got some seed from a wonderful grower in Australia, and this was a result of that. So it's like this peachy pink bloom. It changes color in the fall. It gets more pink in the fall. And it's super productive. I mean, lots of stems per week and makes lots of tubers. So that will be available, hopefully, this coming sale.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to cross my fingers and knock on wood right now because that sounds beautiful.
I never announce what's for sale until I get all the dividing done and all the inventory done, because anything can happen. Because I actually had a coral bloom on the docket for this year's sale and I had to take it off. I just didn't get to dividing them as soon as I wanted to. And crown rot really just settled in on this variety in the stem. And I lost a lot of viable tubers when I was dividing. So I didn't have enough, or I didn't meet my minimum of tubers that I like to launch with. And so it's going to hang out for another year. And hopefully this next year will be the year.
Wow. Oh, that's too bad about the crown rot.
It happens. I mean, in farming, if it can happen, it will. And so you just have to adjust to the risk.
Definitely. Well, that was one thing I wanted to ask about was dahlia diseases, because I think that there's obviously been a lot of dahlia virus. Do you think that dahlia virus is something that has always existed and it's just we're learning about it more now, or home customers like me are learning about it? Or is this something that you've kind of always known about?
I've known about plant viruses being in ag. And so it's very common, or at least growing up in commercial ag, to be aware of viruses in a lot of the commercial crops, like your corn, your soybeans, and particularly your produce, like cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers. And I'm not have personally grown them on our farm, but there was neighbors that did. And so it was always an awareness. In fact, I think the most aware of dahlia mosaic virus that's out there, there's actually one called dahlia mosaic virus, but there's a tomato spot wilt virus, which is a mosaic virus. And that's the one that most people are talking about, at least this year in 2022. This virus has been around since the early 1900s. It came into the U.S. with a fury in the late 1970s, and in the 1980s, it took about a decade for it to really take hold, but it wiped out so many commercial crops. And what it does is it'll form and get into the plant and form these mosaic structures, which are round, and circles, which will eventually become like a necrotic spot where it'll die out. And if you're killing the leaves, you're killing the plant. It'll also infect certain fruits like cucumbers and tomatoes, and they will start forming these necrotic spots on the fruit itself. So you can see how devastating it can be, and it can produce quite quickly, and it spreads very rapidly through insect vectors. So it caused a lot of economic damage in the 80s, and it's been around the US ever since. Now, these mosaic viruses can infect other species, which makes them even more dangerous. So even though it's in dahlias, they first discovered it in tomato, and that's why it's called the tomato spot wilt virus, because that's where it was first identified. But it actually has hundreds of hosts, including ornamental flowers, produce, and weeds. So it's everywhere.
So if you get dahlia virus growing on one of your dahlias and you don't remove it, then it can spread to other, not just other dahlias, but to other plants in your cut flower area or just in your garden.
Correct. Oh. So any mosaic virus, there's four that I test for, but there's many multiple mosaic viruses, and they can affect dahlias. And you can bring it in on another plant. It can be naturally in your ecosystem to begin with, but any insect that has like a piercing, sucking mouth part, thrips, leafhoppers are a big one for me. Aphids are another.
Okay.
If they travel from plant to plant, that's how they will transmit the virus. They kind of like suck in the plant sap. They go to another plant. They regurgitate that back in the next one, and then it's virused.
Oh no.
I know, it's like worst case scenario. I don't want to be like, you know, like the doomsday message. There is hope. Okay. I mean, you can look to what other ag industries have done to help control it, because it's not new. And you might be learning about it for the first time in your dahlias, and you probably will find it. It's not uncommon, but how you react to the problem is important. So knowing what the signs and symptoms are, and I think more knowledge about that is getting out into the hands of growers. So mosaic viruses can exhibit differently in different species. So if you have like the weed lamb's quarter on your property, it can be infected with a mosaic virus. It'll look and have different symptoms than your tomato plants. And that's why it makes this so difficult. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, just identifying it. And so what kind of signs are you looking for, and how do you determine, you know, do you let something sit for a little bit before you pull it, or how and when do you determine to pull a plant?
So for the last 3 years, I've done an intensive research project of my own.
Wow.
I know, I've spent a lot of money, and it's the science-minded nature of me. I have to know the facts, and if I'm able to, I will. So for the last few years, if there has been a suspicious plant, I am taking leaf samples and had them tested. I've done different kinds of tests, PCR test, ELISA test, and now more recently an in-field comb test using a solution from a company called Agdia, which I've worked with that company, and they have also tested dahlias to say that yes, this in-field test is accurate in this plant. That's not always the case, but they were able to determine that for me. But I've also taken leaves to send out for nutrition analysis, because sometimes what we have heard or symptoms can look nutrition-based, or it can look diseased for virus. And then, of course, there's the whole pest damage too that can sometimes throw people for a loop.
Hard to tell which is which sometimes. So the tests probably help.
Yes. So for specifically tomato spot wilt virus, this is the most common virus I will find in my patch when tested. Okay. For me here in the East Coast. I've sourced dahlias from different parts of the country, and I've had other mosaic viruses, but this is the one that I find the most. This will exhibit a clear yellow circle that will grow. So at first, when you notice it, it just looks like a speck. And then you come back a week later and it looks slightly larger. What makes this virus different from nutrition is the fact that they seem to be erratic on the plant. They're not following a vein, and the spot will grow. With pest damage, you can also see yellow spots because the plants are killing the tissue underneath. But they'll appear to be pitted or dented. And if you turn the leaf over, you'll see the damage on the other side of the leaf where they've been actively gnawing or eating the leaf structure. So there's some differences that you can look at. But more importantly, with mosaic virus, they'll start to form concentric circles or mosaic rings around this area. And that's okay. That is the confirming nature of this virus, which means it's also been in your plant for a little while, because this is the most advanced sign that I've seen in dahlias, other than it moves on to that necrotic spot where the plant material dies away.
So if you have one that's exhibiting a ring and it's nearby to others that are starting to show the little specks, and you can't find signs of insect damage, do you think that could mean it has transferred to the others and it's just newer in those? Or
I watch.
Okay.
You know, it's really determined on what your management program is. And I will say that my management program is pretty intense, because I take my responsibility as a creator and innovator of new dahlias and also the propagator of that to be, you know, pretty high bar. Like, I'm introducing brand new stock to a market, it better be in the best possible condition. So I have a three-pronged approach where I do prevention, which includes pest management. So I'm actively out there managing pests in different ways the moment they emerge from the soil.
Okay.
So if I see something that's suspicious, and I do, because dahlia virus and disease is everywhere, it's going to happen to anyone.
Yeah.
I think the stigma about, oh, you found virus in your patch, your place is dirty, needs to go away.
Yes.
No progress is going to happen if we don't actively work together as a community to educate ourselves and then clean it up. Or we'll find ourselves in the position like the tomato and pepper growers in the 80s did, where whole fields were just being torn up because they were infested. So with that being said, I do the prevention with pest management, and I have a weekly routine, so they're taken care of. I do a detection, so I use the Agdia test strips. I also make sure I'm monitoring my plants on a daily basis, and I'm looking the whole plant. I also keep track of any of the new plants I bring in. I plant them in a different quarantine area. So I'm more aware about stock that I know that hasn't originated on my own property. And then there's the remediation step, which is how I deal with the problem. It's complete removal of the plant, including the tuber and any of the roots. I try to get it all lifted up out of the ground. I trash it. I don't compost it. And even if I test something and it says that it's negative, tests are technology. They can fail. And you just have to use your common sense. And if I'm pretty sure it's not a nutrition issue and I have my pests under control, I throw it out. I don't care what it is. So the choices you make about what you bring in, and then just following the evidence and not necessarily all the tests, because, you know, nothing's 100% accurate, will do a lot for you moving forward.
Can any plants heal themselves from these viruses? Or is this something that once a plant has it or a patch has it, it's pretty much that patch has to immediately be thrown out?
I'm not an expert in this, but I know that plants do have immune systems, but I've never read a report where they've been completely healed of a virus.
Okay.
They've been proven to show resistance to. In the tomato and pepper fields, there's a lot of evidence to show that offspring has changed and evolved to, they're more resistant to the virus. And even if they're exposed, they've shown negative into tests. So there's a lot of research in those commercial products in regards to that. But I don't believe a dahlia can ever heal itself, but it can be asymptomatic as a plant.
And then speaking of this, I mean, there's so many questions that people seem to have about virus and about dahlias. Are you planning on offering any online courses about this or about growing dahlias?
I am. It was on my docket to get them out in the world last year. I had a lot happen last year, and it's just something I had to put on hold. So I'm using the months of July and August to get classes, because I do enjoy doing them. I've done them online in the past, into a format where you can purchase them at any time and view them at any time. So COVID has actually helped lead the way with tech, because I think during that time when we were all in a shutdown and we had to function, we still wanted to learn. And so some amazing entrepreneurs have created software to allow people like me to share this information. And I'm hoping to get that out here probably in the third quarter of this year.
I was able to take one of your classes. I can't remember if it was last year or the year prior, but it was wonderful. So I was hoping that you'd be offering more online ones that people could take at any time.
I know. And that's interesting. Like you hear something, but then the next season comes around and you're like, where are my notes? I don't remember a thing. So to have it as a reference is important. I 100% agree that having that would be a huge benefit.
Well, people should take your class, but just as some basics, if someone's kind of growing dahlias for the first time, can you just give some baseline advice for how you would tell that person just some ideas of how to grow a healthy dahlia?
Oh, sure. So the dahlias that I grow, now there are many different forms. There's landscape or bedding dahlias that stay shorter, but if you're buying from a farmer, it's most likely a cut flower, which is going to be a larger plant because we need the stem length to be able to cut and keep the plant healthy and also provide a stem to create an arrangement with. So when you plant a dahlia, you want it in a place that has about 6 hours of sunlight. So it's very similar to the conditions that a tomato plant would need. So if you're familiar with that, or a zinnia, you just want to plant them in a similar spot, but provide support. If you're growing just a couple plants, a tomato cage works well, or staking the individual plant, people do. I use a netting system. People do the corral method where they plant in rows and put baler twine around, but support's important. And I like to plant my dahlias with some sort of time release fertilizer. Contrary to some of the older materials out there about growing dahlia, dahlias are very hungry. And when you're producing dahlias for cut flowers, we need them to have enough nutrition to continually produce. So a well-balanced time release fertilizer is helpful when we forget. If you are someone that likes the maintenance of weekly foliar feeds, life happens and then the plants get hungry. So having nutrition there is important. I always recommend anybody who's serious into growing to do a soil test in the fall so you know exactly what you need. And water is very important after they emerge from the soil.
Okay.
So you want to be careful not to overwater dahlias when they're just starting to grow. Rot is a primary factor that dahlias fail in the first 6 weeks. Rainwater is okay, but you just don't want to be running the soaker hose on them for hours at a time until they break the surface. And then after that, you can pretty much water them as long as there's no standing water, and they'll do fine for you.
And what are some of the common mistakes that you see people making in growing and caring for dahlias?
One is not providing support. The other is not pinching the dahlias. The normal uninhibited growth habit of a dahlia is to grow a singular large stem really tall and have a flower at the top of that. If you were to take off that top terminal bud when they're about 8 to 10 inches tall or have 6 to 8 leaf sets, sometimes they, you know, dahlias grow a little bit different, a little stockier different times. But if you're just to pinch that off, what you will find is that the lateral stems that are little buds at each leaf segment that attaches to the stalk will start to grow. And there you'll have multiple flowers on each one of those stems. So just by pinching, you'll delay your first flower for about 2 to 3 weeks, but you'll get many more flowers and an actually a much healthier plant that'll be stronger for you throughout the entire season.
And is there a best time of day or like weather situation to pinch your dahlias in?
I like to do the plants as early as possible as far as their stage and growth. If you wait until later when they're a bit taller, the stems hollow out. And if you pinch at that time, it'll leave an open area to collect rainwater or if you're doing overhead irrigation. And when that water goes down in that stem, it increases the chance that a dahlia will begin to rot. And that's where I'll lose a couple plants each year. So I try to plant on or pinch on days where I know it's not going to rain, just in case I missed one and it's more mature. But life happens and sometimes you can't help when you pinch or you miss one. And the first bloom you get is actually going to be its first pinching.
That's where I'm at with a couple of mine, because I just went on a 10-day trip and I can't believe how much everything grew in 10 days. And then I came back and some of mine are, you know, 18 inches tall now. And so I really need to get out there, but I'm looking out the window and it looks a little bit cloudy. So I'm nervous to pinch today. So maybe tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, I think dahlias double in size every week.
Wow.
Like the first 8 weeks that they are blooming. I mean, it's not exact, but like they really do grow super fast. In fact, the first buds that I have out in the field right now are because I missed the pinching when I went on vacation in June.
And so you let them flower and then pinch. Okay.
I did. I am going to, because I'm a little greedy and I want to see the blooms earlier.
That makes sense. Well, one question that we got was about your partnership with Australian growers. And I know you mentioned that a little bit before, but is that an ongoing partnership?
It is. Now, the rules changed as far as swapping seeds and plant materials. Always be aware if you're going to reach out to a farmer, what the rules are about importing and exporting ag products. That's really important. And the rules have changed for Australia. So I'm not sure exactly right now what that means for us. I hope to continue it. But my goal as a breeder was to get new genetics in to use in my breeding program. And that's originally why I started doing that. And I have done that. So a lot of the blooms that I first got from the first swaps are now part of my breeding program.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. And I hope there can be more of that, like, international connection. I know there's a couple of friends that I have in England that I wish I could ship things to. So
the desire's there. So finding international plant flower friends is super fun.
Yeah. And then do you have anything coming up that you'd like to talk about? I don't know, like you talked about your online courses, maybe when you think approximately your upcoming sale will be next year.
I've been told by my husband that I'm very ambitious and that I need to stop being so ambitious. But yeah, the new educational content is a beast of its own. So that is my biggest thing for this year, to get out into the world. And then the new varieties, I always wait to announce the sale until after I get all my dividing done. I don't think I'll ever change. I don't like pre-selling. Farming's risky enough.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of adverse, and I've seen so many people get burned because anything can happen with storage, and it's out of your control. And so I generally wait, and I know customers get a little anxious because they want something. So I just suggest getting on my email list, which you can sign up from my website. Because I make all my first announcements on that, and of course with social media and Instagram. But that's where you can find out when I will be launching new products, new classes, seeds, tubers. I don't send out a lot of information or a lot of emails, but when something big is happening, you'll know about it.
And how can people, where is your website and your Instagram? How can people find that?
You can find it at cozytownflowers.com, and Cozy Town is spelled with an S. So it's CoseyTown. It's the road I live on.
Oh, okay. I was wondering where that came from. I love it.
It's such a fun, nice, pleasant name. I've loved it since I moved to the area. So I always thought it would make a good farm name, and here I am. And then you can find me on this as with the same name on Instagram and Facebook.
Okay, great. And then the last thing that I wanted to ask you that I think comes up a lot for someone like yourself that's ambitious and has a lot going on, how do you take care of yourself and sort of recharge and refuel during the season? Or is it just kind of an all out, you know, 6 to 8 months of chaos?
Done both. I don't like the chaos part. I would say this. I've certain times, farming is seasonal, and sometimes I don't treat myself with that seasonal view. Like, I never expect my plants to have 100% growth year round. So why would I be an expectation for myself?
Right.
And so I think about that, and I'm trying to view life in seasons. And I'm given my permission to say no or not now, even if they're good things. So that's the best way that I can protect myself as a wife and mother and my business from overextending myself and then not doing anything well.
Okay, that's very helpful. Saying no to things, even if they're good, sometimes we have to do.
The other big thing I did this year and I didn't think about is I actually hired routine help this year.
Good.
I got to the point, and that's scary because you have to start evaluating your business a little bit different when it's all in your head and you're trying to explain it to someone else. That's scary. And things don't get done the way you expect them to. So there's some learning on how to evaluate the processes of a building or a business so you can hand that off to someone and still get the results you expect. So there's some personal growth there this year for me, but having help has been amazing. It's taken me obviously less time to get the same amount of work done because there's more hands and I'm really enjoying that.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear that. That definitely helps balance everything. And okay, very last thing. Can you tell us a little bit about your puppy that we see sometimes on your Instagram?
Is it a requirement of flower farmers to also have a dog? Like I just joined that club. Dog parents are their own special culture and I'm just now getting a taste of it.
Is this your guys' first dog?
As a family, yes. She is an English black lab. Her name is Dolly. We talked about a name forever. And honestly, when I say it out loud, it seems like a strange name, but it just suits her so well. And she's going to be a great dog in about 2 years. I mean, she's 6 months old right now. And in the teenage years where, you know, she only listens to me if I have a treat in my hand, but we're working through that. She almost didn't live another day though. She tore up a couple of my seedlings, including a couple KA varieties and a new AC Twisp. I don't know if people have heard of it. It's new and it's gorgeous. And so she ate them.
Oh no.
Dolly. True fact, dahlias are not poisonous to dogs.
You can speak from experience on that one. Yeah, that's a rough intro to the season, Dolly.
So I still love her. She's still around. She's doing better. And our family is really enjoying her company. And like I said, in a couple years, she's going to be the perfect dog.
Good. Well, thank you so much for joining today, Leanne. It was great talking to you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
It was so cool to get to speak to Leanne. I hope you guys love the interview. She's just full of so much incredible knowledge that she's really generous and willing to share. And I'm a fan of following along on her Instagram. I love seeing her flower journey. I love getting sneak previews of the varieties that in her breeding patch, the different colors and forms that she's seeing. And just learning a lot about dahlias through that, and also about insects and other aspects in the garden that are really helpful. And then I'm just a huge fan of her plants. You guys heard before, but I'm growing several of her varieties in the garden. They're really sturdy, really healthy, throwing off a lot of blooms. And when I compare them to some of the fussy varieties that I spend so much space and time growing, like for example, a Cafe au Lait, which last year for me waited all season until the fall to bloom and then only threw off a few blooms before it shut down for the season. Compared to that, I'm just really having a great experience with the Cozy Town varieties I've grown this summer and last summer. And so I just can't speak highly enough about the program that Leanne is running. Okay, let's get you guys over to the flower fact of the week. The question was, how many dahlia forms are there according to the American Dahlia Society, and how many can you name? And so if you have that little list in your brain, be listening along because the answer to the question is 29 different dahlia forms according to the ADS, and I'm going to read through them really quickly, just like at the end of those pharmaceutical ads where they tell you all the different side effects you can have. I'm going to read real quick here. Okay, formal decorative, informal decorative, semi-cactus, straight cactus, incurved cactus, lacinated ball, miniature ball, pompon, stellar, microstellar, water lily, micro water lily, novelty double, micro novelty double, peony, micro peony, anemone, micro anemone, novelty open, micro novelty open, collarette, mini collarette,
orchid, mini orchid, orchette, micro orchette, single, and mignon single. So you can hop online to check out what all of those look like and drop a line to let me know which kinds you're growing in your garden this year. So I wanted to close out with a cute little clip from my convo with Leanne. And then your song of the week this week is God is a Woman by Ariana Grande.
And one more thing I wanted to check on is, do you pronounce your last name Huber?
Yes, like tuber. Okay. It's a running joke with my friends. They're like, Leanne, why didn't you name your business Huber Tubers? And I never even considered it. Like, it never crossed my mind. And I laugh about it to this day. So, yes.